happy to be here to talk to you guys today about some crazy ideas in cosmology that hopefully you find interesting. And I should mention, feel free to interrupt me at any point during the talk and ask any questions that you have. That's okay too. Okay, so the title of my talk is Searching for Other Universes, because understanding only our universe is just not complicated or interesting enough. Okay, so here's a movie of what the universe might look like on the very largest scales. Okay, so you have this background, and this background is causing space itself to expand because it's filled with this stuff called dark energy that we'll talk about. And then every once in a while, just like a pot of boiling water, you have these bubbles that form from this phase. And this is a phase transition, like water going to steam, for example, in that pot. And so this background gives rise to all of these bubbles. And then maybe somewhere in this soup of bubbles, you will find a little pocket that looks just like our observable universe. So this is a scenario called the multiverse. Multiverse because each of these bubbles contains a universe in its own right, containing, you know, galaxies, stars, the cosmic microwave background radiation. I'll leave this movie up because it's pretty cool. So if you go deeper inside this bubble, you will find galaxies. Eventually, we'll zoom into our own Milky Way galaxy and then end up on the Earth. So it's a crazy idea. But it's a crazy idea that's kind of thrust upon physicists by the laws of nature. And so today during the talk, I hope to explain a little bit about where this idea comes from, and then also a little bit about how we might test this idea. Okay, so there's the Milky Way. So this is the multiverse, but maybe let's start a little bit more basic, and let's talk about the universe, right? And so first thing you might ask me is, well, what does a multiverse mean anyways? I mean, I thought the word universe was supposed to mean everything that there is. And that's true. So it's a lot of wordplay. So what is the universe? It's everything, right? But if you ponder the universe, and so what do we mean by everything? You'll realize that that concept has changed a lot through history. So this used to be everything. Okay, so we were, you know, cave people or wherever we came from. And we lived in the forest, and our universe was really small. So it was basically everything that we could interact with locally. So let's define a concept. Let's define the local universe. And that's just going to correspond to everything that we can interact with. And of course, everything that we can interact with changed as history went on. So eventually, we realized that there's more outside of our little woodland home. In fact, we inhabit a planet. And then as we built telescopes, we learned that, in fact, our planet was one among many orbiting the sun. And then as technology got better, telescopes got bigger, we could see out even further. But before we get there, the local universe kind of ends here. So at the planet formerly known as Pluto, let's say, or maybe some asteroids if we could ever get there. And these are the places that we can go. Right, so this is the local universe, the places we can interact with. I can send a spaceship now, and we have the technology to actually reach any of these planets, and then, you know, maybe someday send people there. So this is the local universe, everything we can interact with. And as I said, as you know, technology got better, we built telescopes, and telescopes allowed us to see further than what we can interact with. So there's a distinction here. Now I'm going to talk about something else, which is the observable universe. Okay, and that's everything that we can observe, but not necessarily everything that we interact with or could interact with. And to understand the observable universe, we need to understand a property of the finite speed of light. Okay, and that is that looking out further is the same thing as looking back in time. And that's because light travels at a constant speed. So if I have some plot of time versus space, and here's some galaxy which emits some light at the distant past, and that light's heading towards me on the Earth, which let's say is that little ball there. Then only today would I receive light from this galaxy, and that could be millions of years ago. So if we look at the sun, it takes about 8 minutes for light to get from the sun to the Earth. So if the sun exploded, you'd have 8 minutes to be happy and not know about it, then I'll die. The moon is about 1 minute away. So when the astronauts went to the moon, you know, imagine having a phone conversation with someone where there's a 1 minute delay. It's kind of annoying. But for galaxies, it's really annoying because there's a 2 million year delay. So if you want to talk to your alien friends in a distant galaxy, it's probably going to be a pretty long and drawn out conversation. I'd start with more than, hey, how's it going? So, you know, we can see out pretty far now. So we can see stars in our own galaxy. So this is a picture of a globular cluster, a collection of stars in the galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. And extending this sphere further, we can see that we live in a galaxy of our own, the Milky Way, and then we can also see other galaxies. But we hit a roadblock here. This is the cosmic microwave background radiation. This is the cloud that makes the universe a gray and cloudy place for all of time. It basically is the cloud that hides the Big Bang from us. Okay. So what is the CMB? The CMB is radiation that was released when neutral atoms were formed in the early universe. So you've all heard of the Big Bang theory. This is the fact that the universe, when it was very young, was very hot and dense. And when things are hot enough, you can't have neutral atoms. It's just impossible for the electrons to stick to the protons for long enough for you to have anything that sensibly looks like an atom. And a soup of positive and negative charges, well, this is called a plasma, and plasmas are totally opaque to light. So the universe literally had a cloud, if you go back far enough in time. So here's a cartoon diagram of that. So on the vertical axis, there's time, and on the horizontal axis, there's space. So if I look here in the early universe at an early time, I have all these electrons and protons, and they're all separate, and light is going around like it's in a cosmic pinball machine. So every time light gets close enough to one of these electrons or protons, it bounces off, and then bounces off, and bounces off. And there's a lot of light because the universe is really hot, right? And of course, heat is a form of electromagnetic radiation. And then, all of a sudden, as the universe grows and cools, it becomes favorable for these electrons and protons to find each other and match up. Okay? And the universe is neutral, so of course, every electron has a true love as a proton, and they find each other and live happily ever after. And so at this time, once you form neutral hydrogen, that's clear, right? So the universe goes from being opaque to being transparent. Much like if I look in altitude, you know, if I'm inside the cloud, it's totally opaque, but then as the water vapor concentration gets lower, I get outside the cloud, and then everything's hunky-dory. I can see it's clear. And from this time, all of that light that was trapped in here is now sort of free to travel, and we still receive it today. So all of that light we can collect. In fact, if you turn on a television, about 1% of the fuzz that you see on a television, but you guys don't even know about what analog TVs are with antennas anymore because it's all digital now, but ask your parents when they used to have big antennas on the roof, about 1% of the fuzz that is on your TV, if you own such an old-fashioned TV, is actually light from this time. And this happened about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. In other words, about 13.6 to 13.7 billion years ago. Now, it's cool, but there's kind of a downside, right, which is the fact that we'll never collect light from further away. So this really is kind of the end of the line for the observable universe. I should say, you know, if we're some future civilization, maybe in the future we can see in neutrinos, or we could see in gravitational waves. And then we could see much further back. We could actually probe this opaque region. But the problem is, the reason we can see back far is because neutrinos and gravity waves don't really interact with anything. Okay, but so I can see back further, but then the flip side of that is they're really hard to detect because they don't interact with anything. It's not like a TV receiver. You know, we need to use the whole Earth as a giant neutrino detector to figure out what's going on. So maybe not in your lifetime, but maybe someday. Okay, so since we've reached the boundary of our observable universe, we need to think about how we can go further. OK, Okay, one way is to see in neutrinos or gravity waves, but there's another way, which is to use physics. Okay, so now we can define another concept, which is the inferred universe. And that's basically everything that we think exists based on our theoretical models of the world. So we can try and use what we see at this cosmic cloud to extrapolate backwards in time what could have happened. And of course, that's an extrapolation, so it requires a theoretical model. So what is our best theoretical model of cosmology that can allow us to see back even further than this? So you just need to turn on the TV, and you can learn about our best theoretical model and the people that build it. Of course, it's this Big Bang theory, okay? So our whole universe started in this hot, dense state, and then it expanded. So what do we mean by that? Let's unpack it a little bit and put it at a scientific level slightly above the TV show, but maybe not too far. It's a really good TV show, I have to say. A lot of the jokes in there you don't get, but physicists, well, maybe you guys are all aspiring physicists, so I bet you get all of the good jokes. Like the wrong sign and the beta function for QCD. If you know what I'm talking about, kudos to you. Okay, so here is the Big Bang. And one thing I'd like to emphasize right off the bat is that the Big Bang is not a place from which everything came. It's actually a time. So the Big Bang happened everywhere. It's not like some point where things exploded from. And it makes sense to talk about a piece of the Big Bang, just like it makes sense to talk about a piece of this room. So if I take a piece of the Big Bang and I ask what happens to it, well, it expands, and this piece gives rise to this really big universe because the universe is expanding. And then it cools, and eventually it gets filled with galaxies and structure and life and us. And these galaxies are moving apart from each other. So that's kind of the basic picture, right? You could get that from the song, basically. Now, one really, really key part about our model that's supported by observation is the fact that the universe is nearly homogeneous, meaning it's the same on average everywhere I go, and it's isotropic, meaning that if I stand at a point and I look around me, it's going to look the same in every direction. And this was something that was discovered first by these two guys in 1978. You know, kind of a recent development if you think about it. So this is Penzias and Wilson, and that's their radio telescope. And they were trying to observe some quasar or some pulsar. I don't know. I'm not an astronomer or an astrophysicist, so I actually don't know what they meant to observe. But they built this radio telescope, and they looked at different directions on the sky, and they found that there was this noise in every direction on the sky that was polluting their measurements. And so they first thought, well, maybe there's some birds nesting in our telescope that are doing this. So they went up there and they, you know, chucked out the birds. And then they thought there were bats that were pooping in their detector. So then they went up and they scared away the bats and, you know, put all sorts of fake owls around and cleaned the poop from their detector. And no matter how hard they tried, they could not get rid of this annoying noise that seemed to be everywhere around them. And then they went down the street and they talked to their colleague, George Gamow. And he said, oh, well, actually, I have a theory that predicts this. And my theory is that the universe used to be really hot and dense, and then at some point it cooled and became transparent, and there's this light, and it's everywhere. It's all around us. It's just waiting to be found. And then these guys realized, oh, well, this is an amazing discovery. In fact, I don't have birds pooping in my detector. I have discovered the Big Bang itself. Okay, and for that realization, they were awarded the Nobel Prize in 1978. So here's a modern picture of the CMB. If you've ever read any popular account or, you know, news article or something on the CMB, you see this picture. It looks like there's so much detail in this picture. It's really amazing. Like, if you could see in microwaves, the sky would be such an interesting place. But in fact, it would be a really boring place because that picture, in a sense, is a little bit of a cheat. So if I looked at the CMB using that huge radio telescope that Penzias and Wilson built, this is what I'd see. It would look almost exactly the same in every single direction. And it would look the same in every direction to about one part in 100,000. So this picture that I show you here, this is really subtracting off everything. It's like turning the contrast on your TV up by a factor of a million. And then you can get something that looks like that. But what we learn from this, the fact that it looks almost the same in every direction, is that the universe is nearly isotropic. Okay, so at least from our position on the Earth, the universe looks almost the same in every single direction. And then there's this other piece that it's homogeneous, and that's kind of an assumption. We actually don't really know that because we can't travel to that galaxy and then send our messages back in 2 million years. But it's an assumption. It's a fairly safe assumption to say that we don't exist in a special place in the universe, just like, you know, the universe doesn't revolve around us. We kind of threw away that idea a few hundred years ago. Okay, so the universe is nearly homogeneous and isotropic. And if you measure these fluctuations and you study their statistics, you'll find that it's actually statistically isotropic as well. Meaning that if I look at the variations, one part in 100,000 look the same in that direction on the sky as they do in that direction on the sky. And that's something that also was a Nobel-worthy prize. So this prize was awarded in 2006 to John Mather and George Smoot for the COBE experiment. That was the first satellite experiment to measure these variations in the CMB. So another part of our model that's supported by observation is that the universe is undergoing accelerated expansion. So not only is it expanding, but it's expanding faster and faster all the time. And these three guys won a Nobel Prize for studying supernovae. So supernovae are what are known as standard candles. They emit the same light no matter where they are, it seems. That's what we think. And by studying the amount of light we receive, we can learn something about how far away they could be. And by comparing how far away they could be with how far we predict they could be, we can learn something about how far away they actually are. Okay, so the universe is undergoing this accelerated expansion. So those are the facts. And now our theory comes from this guy. Okay, so if we have a model for what's in the universe, then Einstein can tell us how to predict how the universe evolves. And that comes from his theory of general relativity. So there it is. You can memorize that and go home and write it on the chalkboard and say you now know all about general relativity. It's a deceptively simple equation. For those of you who have taken calculus, this is actually 10 coupled partial differential equations. So when you unpack it, it's really not easy. But you can encapsulate Einstein's equations by two things. So on the left-hand side, I've got all these terms. So these r's, they correspond to the curvature of space-time. So this is the warping of space-time that if you've ever watched any Discovery Channel or anything that mentions gravity, I'm sure you've seen these rubber sheets. Okay. That's what this is. This is measuring the curvature of space-time itself. This is something we'll meet later. This is called the cosmological constant, that Einstein's biggest blunder that turned out to be his biggest success. And then, so that's the left-hand side. That's space-time curvature. And then on the right-hand side, we have matter and energy. That basically is the thing that lives inside this T. So if I know the matter and energy content of the universe, then Einstein's equations tells me how space curves and therefore how it evolves with time. So here's what we think the universe is made out of. This is what's going to go on the right-hand side of the equation. 74% of the universe we think to be dark energy. That's the stuff that fills the universe, causing it to undergo the accelerated expansion. 22% we think is this stuff called dark matter. That's the stuff that glues galaxies together so that they don't fly apart, because there's just not enough matter to glue them together. And then about 4% is atoms and light and basically everything we know. So it's a safe assumption to say that we don't understand 96% of the entire universe. So plenty of jobs if you guys want to be aspiring physicists or cosmologists. 96% left to go. Okay, as I said, that's the accelerated expansion part. And this model has a name. It's called lambda CDM. Lambda is this cosmological constant term. That's the dark energy part. CDM stands for cold dark matter. And that's the other part of the pi. So it's kind of a boring name. It's just named after the pi. It's mostly lambda aka dark energy and dark matter. Okay, so that was a little bit of a diversion, but now I want to bring us back to the inferred universe. So now we have a theory that's basically general relativity and the stuff that we think fills the universe. That's this model lambda CDM. And we can use this model to infer what happens in the past. So here's the cosmic cloud, that's the CMB. And there's another feature that we should talk about really quickly, and that's the fact that when we look back in time, again, this is a time and space diagram. I told you when we look back in time, I look farther out, right? But I don't see the entire universe. Actually, I can only see things, you know, from if it's a certain time in the past, I see things from a certain distance. Okay, so the things that we can see actually live on what is called a light cone. And that is this triangular shape that I've drawn here. So we don't see everything in the universe. We just get a snapshot. And a snapshot at a given time corresponds to things going on at a given distance. So here's our snapshot of the CMB. This picture is kind of a lie, because actually we only see what's right here and what's right here. But that's the cloud. And then if we go back in time, we can infer that the universe was hotter. Because Einstein's equations tell us that if the universe is expanding here and today, that it's expanding even faster in the past. Okay? And it's much hotter, much more dense. And eventually it gets hot and dense enough to synthesize atoms. So nuclear fusion can happen just as it does in the sun. Most of the helium and lithium in the universe comes from this time. And that's something that we can predict based on our theory. And then we can go out and measure because it turns out that most production mechanism from stars is just not big enough to account for how much there is. That's a very tiny portion. So most of it had to come from somewhere else, and we can predict how much came from that something else and measure it, and the agreement is spectacular. So that's an indirect piece of evidence that the universe was even more hot and dense than it was at the CMB. And then if we go back even further, it turns out that this model lambda CDM predicts its own demise. And in fact, there had to be this epoch called inflation, which is this period of exponential accelerated expansion with densities that are enormous, like 10 to the 85 kilograms per cubic meter. You have this dark energy at that density, and it's just causing the universe to rip apart very, very fast. Consequently, that theory, because it rips apart so fast, actually induces ripples in space-time itself, which show up in this picture here. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Okay, so that's our inferred universe. Everything that we think exists based on theoretical models, so I'll just draw a few more pictures to kind of harp this one home. Here's the Earth. Here is some past time. So we get to see the surface of this ring. That's our past light cone. And so things that lie on our past light cone, we can see them in the past, but we don't see them as they are today. We don't think that galaxy stops existing just because we can't see it. And so that galaxy is part of the inferred universe, right? Just like the sun right now is part of our inferred universe. We don't think the sun is just going to disappear, even though I can't see it until eight minutes from now. These other galaxies that I've drawn here are also part of this inferred universe, because we don't think the universe stops existing outside of our light cone. Right? So there is stuff that we can't see, but nevertheless, there's no good reason to assume that it doesn't exist. You know, why would the universe stop right where we can't see it anymore? Okay, so these are all part of the inferred universe as well. Okay, and we can ask also now, given our model, you know, we can predict what the future of these galaxies is. Even though we can't see them, we can say something about perhaps what they might see. And a big part of the story about what the future holds revolves around this question: what is dark energy? So the basic property of dark energy, the thing that makes the universe undergo accelerated expansion, is the fact that regular matter dilutes as the universe expands. So if I had four galaxies and the universe expanded, You can see that the density of these galaxies goes down as the universe expands. That's what we're used to. I double the size of a box, you know, I decrease the density of gas inside it. And dark energy does not do that. It's this very strange substance that if I doubled the size of my box, it would actually stay at the same density. Crazy. So why aren't you throwing things at me? Oh, energy is conserved, and you know, I learned this in class. This is bullshit. So it's really weird stuff. It's not like any kind of stuff we see around us. So dark energy just doesn't dilute. And the reason that conservation of energy and these things don't really work is that it turns out in Einstein's theory of general relativity, you'll have to unlearn everything you learned about conservation of energy. Maybe some of the projects you're going to do this week or people you'll talk to this week, that'll come up. But nevertheless, it is true that I can double the size of the box, keep the density constant, but I do not violate conservation of energy. Something for you to puzzle on. Yeah?
How do I know that the density of it doesn't change?
So if I believe the equations of general relativity, then the only kind of stuff that will cause the universe to undergo the expansion we observe has this property. And so it comes through that. It's like we make this observation, we have a model, which is general relativity, and then the thing I have to assume about my model is that there's some stuff that doesn't dilute in order to explain the observation. Any other questions? So I haven't really told you what dark energy is, but one explanation is that it is this thing called the cosmological constant. So if I go back to the famous Einstein equation, this is just some term in the Einstein equation. In fact, Einstein invented this term to make the universe not expand, ironically. So he thought the universe was full of galaxies and matter likes to attract. So in a universe where matter likes to attract, eventually it's going to recollapse, right? Even if it starts out expanding, it's going to come back together because the matter is attracting. So he wanted to add this term that's like a repulsive force that would exactly balance the attraction of all the galaxies in the universe and make the universe static. Now, why did he do that? Well, just like us today, he had some observations of the universe, and the observations of the time, well, people didn't even know about galaxies then, okay, so they didn't really have a lot to work on. But the observation of the time was that the universe was static. So we invented this term to make the universe static. And then 100 years later or so, people introduced this term to make it expand. So anyway, Einstein invented this term for the wrong reason, but it turns out to do a really darn good job of explaining what we see today. And if dark energy is lambda, it's a constant in the equation. It doesn't ever go away. And one implication of this is that these distant galaxies, say this one that was on our light cone, is actually now expanding away from us. And it's expanding away from us so fast that even if I wait forever, I will never see it again. Okay, so I can never get to it. I can never interact with it. I can only see it as it was at this distant time in the past. And so if we wait 100 billion years from now, then the universe is actually going to be a pretty lonely place because all of these galaxies that I could see in my past, but now I can't ever get to, will just kind of disappear. It's going to be us and what's known as the local group, and that's it. So if you were a cosmologist 100 billion years from now, you'd really have very little to work with. And you'd see a few galaxies. You wouldn't see the CMB. You wouldn't see all these beautiful images that the Hubble Space Telescope creates. Actually, you could probably travel to most of the galaxies that you could see at that time. And you would never, ever probably learn anything about the Big Bang. So consider yourselves fortunate that you don't live 100 billion years from now. It's way more interesting. Okay, so in this model, if I have a cosmological constant, then the universe splits into this part that's sort of in principle observable, the things that I can like ever see, and this part here that's in principle unobservable. So lambda is this like fundamental limitation on your knowledge. You know, you thought that like me, you know, I took French class and I failed it 3 times. There was this fundamental limit on my knowledge. This is like the universe doing that, right? It's just in principle impossible to know what's out there. But nevertheless, do we think the universe ends at this edge of our knowledge? No, we probably think it goes on. And you know, based on what we see around us, it probably looks a lot similar to what we see around us here. And so this model with lambda predicts a set of observable universes. So that distant galaxy that eventually I won't be able to see anymore, maybe inside it there's an Earth. Maybe not the Earth, maybe not us, maybe there's 6-legged students and 5-legged teachers, I don't know. But you know, just something else to see it, right? And they're gonna see probably something that looks fairly similar to what we see. And so this model, then we can give it a name. Let's call it a multiverse. So that's it. That's the multiverse. There are places that I cannot go, that I cannot interact with, but nevertheless, I infer their existence because I don't think the universe just ends at the boundary of where I can see. So the multiverse is just this set of places, okay, that more or less look the same. But if I have a set of places that more or less look the same, then of course, you know, being theoretical physicists, we can speculate and ask, well, you know, if I build a slightly crazier theory, how different could these different places be? And that's the direction we're going to go in now. Okay, so let's keep talking a little bit about this cosmological constant. So there's a way to predict the value of the cosmological constant using what's known as quantum field theory. So quantum field theory is the theory that describes almost everything we know and love, for example, electricity and magnetism and how it interacts with light, everything that happens at the Large Hadron Collider, everything that we're made out of. You can describe it as a quantum field theory. And just like any quantum theory, there is a zero-point energy. So if I have a hydrogen atom, the ground state of hydrogen does not have zero energy. It has fixed energy. And that's a property of quantum mechanics. So quantum field theory predicts that at each point in space, there is actually a zero-point energy. So the energy density of space-time itself is not zero. It's a fixed number. And actually, it predicts that it's a really huge number. It's about 0.0000, okay, I won't go through the whole thing, but about 120 orders of what we see around us, you know, the inferred energy density due to these guys of dark energy is actually about 120 orders of magnitude off from this prediction from quantum field theory. And this is like the worst prediction ever, I think. I don't know if anyone's ever been off by 120 orders of magnitude, but there it is. Okay, so that's really puzzling because quantum field theory does a really good job of describing almost everything we see around us on the Earth. It's a fantastic job. I mean, you know, the level of precision is maybe not that many zeros, but you know, maybe that many zeros. It's pretty good. We definitely know that the universe is filled with dark energy. So it's really bizarre that this theory predicts dark energy, but it's really, really far off from what we see. So why might that be? So Steven Weinberg came along and he was pondering this question and he asked, well, what if the cosmological constant varies between these different observable universes? What if in one place it takes one value and another place it takes a slightly different value? And let's just say that that prediction that I made, maybe it's not an exact prediction. Maybe I can make the theory more complicated and things can cancel. Or let's say I don't know anything about the theory at all, besides the fact that I get a prediction for a vacuum energy period. So if you ask what universes look like with different values of the cosmological constant, what you'll find is that if lambda is too big, then the universe expands so fast that galaxies never get a chance to form in the first place. Okay, so no life, no structure. Basically, when I told you that the local group will be a really lonely place, the local atom would be a very lonely place in this case, right? It would just expand so fast that you would get no galaxies, no structure. We can't live there. If you make the cosmological constant negative, it has the opposite effect of expansion. It causes recontraction. So if you make the cosmological constant too big and too negative, then the universe will just recollapse, and you don't have time to form galaxies or structure. That takes time. So we can't live there. And this tiny sliver of values of the cosmological constant where you can form galaxies, of course, corresponds very closely to what we observe. And there's no big mystery there. This isn't actually a theory. It's just saying we can't observe what we can't see. If we lived in these other universes with different values of lambda, we would not be around to see it. So we see what we can see because we are here, we exist. And so this is the anthropic explanation for the cosmological constant. To give you an analogy, okay, so what is the consequence? Well, if there are large values of lambda, we just don't live there, so we don't see it. An analogous problem would be to ask the question, is there a fundamental physics reason for why the Earth sits exactly as far away from the sun that it does? I mean, there are other planets in the solar system. Why don't we live on those planets? Or why do I live on a planet that's this close to the sun and not out here? And there's a really simple answer to that question. Here in this dark green that you can't see on this projector slide, I've shown the so-called Goldilocks region. And that's the distance away from a star the size of our sun where you can have liquid water. And we don't exist where there's not liquid water. So it turns out that there is no profound reason why the Earth is this distance away from the sun. It's that distance away from the sun because we're here. Okay? If it wasn't that distance away from the sun, we would not be here. And so you can see from this example that that was just a wrong question. You know, there is no reason why the Earth exists this far from the sun. It just does, because if it was farther away, then we wouldn't live there. So it might be that this explanation for lambda is the same. You know, there are many values of lambda. There's no really profound reason why we live in one place than another. It's just that we could have lived anywhere, but we can only live here. Okay, so that seems like kind of a good explanation, maybe, or maybe not. That's actually kind of a controversial idea. But for this to work, we need to ask if there is a multiverse where the cosmological constant can actually take different values. And it turns out the answer is yes. And where that comes from is string theory. So basically, everything for a very long time, physics, you know, was described as a theory of point particles. And that worked really well until graviton. Not that one, this one. I doubt anyone in this room even knows who that character is. So graviton is the particle associated with gravity. And the graviton is not at all monogamous, so it likes to interact with everything, including itself, many, many times. And the problem with that is that if you ask what the answer to any interaction is, like what is the scattering rate or what is the strength of the force, you will find that the answer is always infinity. So the theory of point particles just doesn't work for gravity. It always gives you infinity. But it turns out if you complicate your life just slightly and you say, well, maybe I don't have point particles, I have the next most complicated thing, which is a line. I mean, it sounds, that's string theory. That's it. It's just, okay, points don't work. What should I try next? Okay, how about lines? And that's pretty much, it turns out, what it is. So if you work out the theory of lines, that's string theory, and you promote it to a quantum theory, you will find that the answers to these questions are no longer infinity. They all turn out to be finite numbers. So you can calculate anything you want. You can calculate the strength of gravity, you can calculate the different interactions. And it turns out that the string does something else for you, which is that a point particle doesn't really have many degrees of freedom, right? I mean, it's a thing. You label it with a number, and that's it. It can be an electron or a proton or whatever. But a string has internal degrees of freedom, so you can have vibrations on a string. And those different vibrations correspond, if I look really far away, my string just looks like a point, they would correspond to different particles. And it turns out you can use strings to describe forces, which we think are mediated by particles, as well as things like electrons and other fundamental particles like quarks. So string theory seems to be really nice. It lets you calculate things in quantum gravity. It unifies all the particles and forces into a theory of lines. Oh, but I forgot to mention that this only works if there are 9 dimensions of space. So it turns out that it's not going to give you answers that aren't infinity unless you pretend that the universe has 9 dimensions of space. That's a big pill to swallow, especially because it doesn't feel like I can move in 9 dimensions of space, only 3. And the solution to that problem that people have come up with is to make the extra dimensions small, so that at each point in this room, string theory says that there is a tiny little 6-dimensional space. And if I could move fast enough, if I could probe it with a high power enough microscope, I'd actually be able to move in those directions of space. But if we are peons on the Earth and I cannot build a particle accelerator the size of the galaxy, then I'll never see it. That's something that appeals to some. To some, smells kind of funny because it's like, okay, well, you built this theory, it predicts these extra dimensions, but then you're telling me that I can't ever see them. Sort that one out for yourself. So to keep the extra dimensions small, they're not just going to stay small on their own. You have to add energy. Okay, so you need to make a big old rubber band ball. And that's actually not a bad analogy. So what you do to make the extra dimensions small is you thread them with electric field lines. And those are like the strings on this ball. And so if I add enough rubber bands, then I can keep my extra dimensions small. But now at each point in space, I've got this rubber band ball full of energy. And it turns out that in string theory is what we call the cosmological constant. So remember, dark energy is stuff that is non-diluting. So there's an energy density at every point in space. And in string theory, that just corresponds to this rubber band ball that's at every point in space. If I make more space, well, there's extra space, so there's directions I can go in those places. So there's no way to get rid of this energy that's stored in the extra dimensions. And that's why it acts like dark energy. But it turns out that there are many ways that I can make these extra dimensions small. So I can make extra dimensions small that look like spheres or toruses with multiple holes, or 10 to the 500 different things that I could possibly imagine.
But then if they're extra dimensions, kind of like we imagine like length and width and height, I mean, what is the meaning of making them these shapes if they're just with the dimensions that we understand?
Mm-hmm. You know?
Like what do they represent, these forms?
So it is exactly like the dimensions that we see around us, except it would be like if I go in this direction, and I walk far enough, eventually I'd come back to where I started. Or like living on the surface of the Earth. I mean, that is the case, right? If I go in a specific direction, if I'm confined to live on the Earth, I'll come back to where I started.
A Mobius strip.
Or like a Mobius strip. That would be a more complicated example, but that's another example, exactly. Yep. Any other questions? Okay, so I have all these possible shapes and all these possible different configurations of my rubber bands. And so that means I can get many possible values of lambda, okay? Because there are many different total energies that I can store in my compact space to make it small. So this is a theory that gives Weinberg his answer, okay? So there is, in a sense, a theory that predicts many different values for lambda, and that is string theory. Problem or feature, I will let you decide. Is 10 to the 500 too many or just enough? Do I have to invent 10 to the 500 different possibilities to explain our universe? Open question. Okay, so this collection of many, many different possibilities actually forms what is known as a landscape. And that's because if I add energy, I can turn a sphere into a torus, or I can turn a torus into a multiple torus, or these different things. So in a sense, all of these different possibilities, they're connected. If I just punch holes in my manifold or deform it in different ways, I can go from one to the other. Or I cut a rubber band here, cut a rubber band there, it will evolve into one of these. So since they're connected, at least in theory space, they're connected, then of course the question arises, in like real space, are they connected? So can I have at one point of space the compact dimensions looking like a torus, and another place looking like a sphere, et cetera, et cetera? And the answer to this question, that's kind of a loaded question, of course, is yes. And how does that work? So that works in analogy with boiling water. I can have phase transitions. So if my universe can exist with many different states of the compact space, then just like water can exist in many different states, well, not many, but at least three, steam, liquid, ice, then maybe the universe can do the same. So for water, how this happens is I heat up my pot and then I form bubbles of steam in my liquid. And those bubbles, once they form, they grow until the pressure is equalized inside and out, and then they stop and then rise to the top and evaporate. And you can do the same thing in cosmology with the whole universe. And it turns out that that just happens on its own thanks to the magic of quantum mechanics. If you learn about a phenomenon called quantum tunneling, then via quantum tunneling, you can form these little pockets, these bubbles, where the extra dimensions change if you just wait long enough. The universe is really old, so we got a long time to wait. So here's how it would look. I have this theory space, this landscape of different possibilities. And each of these little minima correspond, these little local points of stability, they correspond to different shapes of the extra dimension or different sizes. These are the stable points. So if I start here with a piece of the universe, let's say I'm standing here in my potential landscape and lambda is big. Then if I wait long enough, then via quantum tunneling, I will form this little pocket where in fact I've jumped over to this part of the landscape. And in this little pocket, my extra dimensions are a sphere. And let's say that corresponds to a small vacuum energy. When I form this pocket, it turns out that energy has to go somewhere that I liberated by cutting the rubber bands, and some of it can go into heating up the universe. So I make this pocket that's really hot, and then that little pocket expands and cools. And what do you know? I've just created the Big Bang Theory, right? A way of making the universe very hot and dense at some point in time. In this case, the place the energy comes from is the energy stored in the extra dimensions. And then that hot and dense little pocket can grow and look like a universe, maybe like the one that we see. So here and here, lambda is different. And so this is a theory that allows us to change lambda depending on where I am. And of course, the idea, which would be really cool, is if, you know, we lived in one of these little pockets. So if I had a universe that was accelerating, but it wasn't accelerating faster and faster, meaning it wasn't undergoing accelerated expansion, then if I start in this blue phase, maybe after some time I form a little pocket and then that pocket starts to grow. And maybe at some later time, it gets some friends and those pockets start to grow. But eventually, if I wait long enough, you know, I will always sort of kill off this blue phase. So that's like the pot of water. If I boil it for long enough, I will just not have any water left to boil. It will all change to steam. Now, in an accelerating universe, something funny happens. So I start with the universe here is kind of small, and I form a little pocket. And then that pocket starts to grow, and it gets a friend. And then it grows, and it gets another friend. But you can see that unless I form pockets fast enough, then the expansion of the universe is always going to win. Right? So I will always have more blue to convert to white. And that's a phenomenon called eternal inflation. And this happens when the rate at which I form these bubbles just cannot keep up with the rate at which the universe is expanding. So it's kind of like my life. I cannot catch up with all of the new things that come on my desk. So I should call this, I don't know, eternal work or something. But anyway, so you can get this runaway phenomenon. And once I build this blue phase that wants to undergo accelerated expansion because it has this rubber band ball at each point in space, it's really difficult to get rid of that. And that's puzzling because if it starts forming these little pockets and these pockets are each little universes, then it seems like I can just make an infinite number of universes. All I need is this tiny little piece of the blue. And from that tiny little piece, I can create an infinite number of universes. So it's a crazy idea, but remember where it came from. So it just came from asking, what happens when I have a theory of physics that's based on lines instead of points? And you can see how far it's taken us. Okay, so perhaps this is an explanation for the value of the cosmological constant, perhaps not. But that brings us back to this movie. So that's what this movie was all about, and now you can kind of understand the different elements of it. The bubbles are flying apart from each other because of lambda, and then they're forming, and inside of each of these bubbles is a different value for lambda, a different phase that the universe can take. And it will just keep going on and on unless these bubbles form fast enough. If they're always flying apart too fast to meet, then that's it. So it's a crazy idea. It might be well motivated if you think we need a theory of quantum gravity. But of course, as scientists, we should ask ourselves, is it actually science? Meaning, can I verify this picture? Is there any experimental evidence that we live in a pocket, you know, that we came from this soup of bubbles? And the answer is maybe yes. And that comes about because even though on average these bubbles don't collide and sort of fill the universe, you do get little local collisions. So there's always a chance that our bubble will run into another one. And in doing so, we can possibly look for evidence of that event. So here's a cartoon of what that might look like. You can think of our bubble like a gobstopper. So there's different concentric colors in the gobstopper, and those will correspond to different cosmological epochs. So we live in the center of the gobstopper. And if we go out far enough, I get to the CMB. And then if I go out even further, I get to this epoch called inflation. And then if I go out even further, I get to the edge of our bubble. So it's not the edge of everything that there is, it's just the edge of the place where we have the value of the cosmological constant that we see, for example. And so if we run into another bubble, then there will always be a winner and a loser, because you got to go somewhere, right? So we smack into this other bubble, and we either plow through it like the semi-truck hitting some little Hyundai, or we are the Hyundai. And if we see this, and we're still here, then we're the semi-truck, okay? Because if we were the Hyundai, we would be obliterated by this, and we wouldn't be here talking about it. Okay, so we hit this guy, but nevertheless, there's some collision wreckage, right? And that wreckage kind of propagates into our gobstopper, and it can leave evidence of that occurrence on this cosmic microwave background radiation. So it's like a bruise. It's this bruise that happened at a very early time, and it might be there for us to see. So how would we see it? Well, we have to go back to the CMB and talk about one more of its properties, perhaps the most interesting of its properties. So again, in the early universe, things were opaque when these electrons and protons were separate. And then as the universe became transparent, there were some places that had a little bit more of this hydrogen gas than others. So the density of the universe varied a little bit with position. And so when light comes to us from those different regions, it's going to show up as these hot and cold spots. Okay. So this picture here is actually a map of the density at that time. So So the places that are a little bit more dense turn out to be the blue spots. The places that are a little bit less dense turn out to be the red spots. And so I get a map of the density distribution of the universe by looking at the CMB. So if there was some wreckage around from this collision with another universe, then that would leave, sorry, I should have said that, but I will go to my punchline. So if there were some wreckage from the early universe, then it would leave these bruises, and that would correspond to places that got hit and therefore had a little bit more density. And they're circles because if you imagine intersecting two spheres, there's a symmetry there, right? So the intersection of two spheres would be a disk. And that's why you get these disks. So if these things were there in the CMB, then if they were really strong, they'd look like this. Of course, we don't look at that famous picture from WMAP or the Planck satellite and see those things. We see this. So now the detective question is, given that we kind of know what we're looking for if this happened, is there actually any evidence in this data for those signals? And that's something that you can do. So we have some map, and then we can compute something, which is sort of the probability for there to be some number of these bruises given this data set. And there's a few answers that could come out. So that's this plot on the right. The most boring answer is no detection. So if this probability distribution is peaked around zero, that means it's most likely that there's nothing in that data. If that probability distribution is peaked over here, then that means it's most likely there's eight. That would be a really interesting universe to live in. I'd like to live there. And here's what we see. So the real universe is, so far, a little bit boring. So the WMAP satellite, if we analyze the data from the WMAP satellite, tells us that it's most likely that there's nothing there. And that's the answer. So there's this crazy theory. We can make some predictions from it. We can go and look in the data for predictions from this theory. And unfortunately, we don't find any evidence for the existence of these spots. But that's also interesting, because now we can go backwards and we can learn something about that picture, that theoretical picture. Okay, and so we can put constraints on, say, how fast these bubbles could have been forming, because we don't see anything. So anything that predicts we do see something is not consistent with the data. Okay, so this is this observational test of this idea. I think I've probably shown you enough things for you to hopefully have a lot of questions. So why don't I call it a day there?